Shrink Wrap Radio number 277 at the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology, Part 2, with Dr. Ed Diener and others.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Dr. Ed Diener is one of the leading lights of positive psychology. Ed Diener, Ph.D., is the Joseph R. Smiley Distinguished Professor of Psychology at the University of Illinois. He received his doctorate at the University of Washington in 1974 and has been a faculty member at the University of Illinois for the past 36 years. Dr. Diener was the president of both the International Society of Quality of Life Studies and the Society of Personality and Social Psychology, as well as the International Positive Psychology Association. Professor Diener was the editor of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology and the editor of the Journal of Happiness Studies. He's the founding editor of Perspectives on Psychological Science. He has about 300 publications, with about 200 being in the area of the psychology of well-being. Indeed, Professor Diener's research focuses on the measurement of well-being, temperament and personality influences on well-being, theories of well-being, income and well-being, and cultural influences on well-being. Recently, he's been studying the effects of subjective well-being on health and effective functioning. I was privileged to attend the Second World Congress in Philadelphia during July of 2011. I recorded Dr. Diener's opening keynote on my iPhone and later received his verbal permission to reproduce it here. Because it was recorded on an iPhone from my seat in the audience, the audio quality is less than regular listeners to Shrink Wrap Radio have come to expect, but it's quite intelligible. Unfortunately, I missed the first few words, but you should be able to get into the flow of it fairly quickly. By the way, the sound will get better after the first few minutes, so do keep listening. Also, Dr. Diener was kind enough to allow me to upload his presentation slides to the Shrink Wrap Radio site. You'll find a link in the show notes to a PDF file of his presentation slides, and you'll definitely get more out of this by viewing those as you listen. Also included in this episode are a few of the interviews I conducted with other presenters and attendees. I hope these will convey the diversity and excitement of the event. Now, here is Dr. Diener's keynote.
Subjective well-being is beneficial to health, to longevity, even to fertility. And I derive from that, then, that people who are happy ought to survive more, have more kids, and through evolution, they ought to be dominant. People ought to be happy, and I'll show you some evidence on that. There are universal and culture-specific predictors, and this is important to differentiate because I think knowing what the universals of happiness are is important, but also knowing that many findings in our field are still culture-specific and being able to recognize that. So people tell me, oh yeah, all this research shows that married people are happier. But most of that's done in Western countries. And so then you have to ask, is it also true, not just in the U.S., but is it true in Sweden? Is it true among college students? And I'm going to show you some findings that show you that findings across cultures can be quite different for certain things, and those are culture specific. And as a practitioner, you have to be able to recognize that and differentiate that some findings may not apply to your particular group of clients. The third one I want to talk about is that meaning and purpose is so important, as is need fulfillment, of fulfilling Maslow's needs, to life satisfaction. And we can't just have pleasure in life. Pleasure is important, but that we have to have more, and meaning and purpose really can lead to life satisfaction. Then I want to tell you a little bit about an article that's coming out this month on Maslow's needs. And we find that those needs provide impetus to economics, because it said you have to fulfill all of those physical needs first before you can... Well, don't worry about self-actualization when everybody's down here getting food, shelter, clothing, and all that. So what I'm going to show you is you need to be getting all the needs all the time, not in order. And then finally, just touch on the progress we've made on National Accounts of Well-Being that I talked about last time at the last meeting. So happy people seem to have it all. In a recent review, I found out not only do they have better health and longer lives, they also have greater fertility. If they're trying to get pregnant and have a baby, they're more likely to do so than people who are unhappy or stressed out. They are more likely to have healthier babies, and that's partly because they're more likely to carry babies to full term, 9 months, and to have a full weight baby and not have a premature baby and so forth. They are more likely to get married, stay married, and therefore have stable two-parent families. And they have more resources, money and so forth, so they have a better nutrition for their children. And because of that, I started to say, gee, we ought to have more happy people out there, because those are the people who, through evolution, are going to become more frequent, and the unhappy people are going to be deselected out over, you know, the centuries. And I'll show you some evidence for that. So an article we published this year, and this is in Chris's wonderful journal, a journal of applied psychology, health, and well-being. It's really an outstanding journal from the very start. And what Michaela Chan and I did was review 150 studies, and we came to the conclusion that the evidence is clear and compelling, not just that health and happiness are associated, but that in fact, happiness and all three forms of happiness, optimism, positive emotions like enjoying life, and lack of negative emotions, are predictive of health and longevity, and they also are causal of it. And we now have experiments, longitudinal studies, they all point strongly in the same direction, that if you are a happy person, meaning you enjoy life, or you're optimistic, and you have a lack of negative affect, you're more likely to live longer, for example, probably about 6-7 years longer, and on average. And not only that, these effects are cumulative. So negative affect and positive affect both predict, but they predict in addition to each other. They have several and additional prediction of longevity. So this is amazing. So if all this is true, if subjective well-being is advantageous in so many areas, why isn't everyone happy through evolution? Well, in fact, the majority of people in the world are happy. Not everyone's happy, but most people are happy. And we start out with some college student data from an experience sampling study. So this is a couple hundred college students, and we're beeping them, and you can see that 70% is the highest line. That means that many people felt happy 70% of the time, right? And only neutral and unhappy 30% of the time. Now that 70%, they may not have been elated, but they were at least above neutral. Quite a few felt happy 80, 90%. Nobody felt happy 100% of the time. But look down below 50%. You only have a couple individuals who really feel happy less than half the time. So you say, well, this is college students. Of course they're happy, right? They're out getting drunk and God knows what they're doing. They're having a great time. What about real people in the real world? So here is a representative sample of the world from the Gallup World Poll. Now what we have is the percent in each nation of 128 nations of the people who enjoyed much or most of yesterday. I really enjoyed yesterday. And as you can see, the mode is 70% of the people in the country, but you can see that there's countries up as high as 90%. But then look, 50%, that's half the people would enjoy it and half wouldn't. There's only three countries below that point. Now think about it, Zimbabwe, there's some terrible places, and yet most people are still, this is a sort of normal distribution, but it's not around 50%, it's around 75%. It's all scrunched into the upper half. Again, most people in the world are happy, slightly happy, moderately happy. There's still plenty of room for them to learn to be happier, and there's plenty of room for you guys to intervene, but they start out slightly happy, and I think that we're built that way. And then the last thing I wanted to show you was people who have big problems. So we looked at the most troubled people in the World Poll. These are people who this year have been assaulted, gone hungry, and don't have enough money for food and shelter. This is a really serious group. 57% of that group said they enjoyed most of yesterday, and 62% said, I smiled and laughed a lot yesterday. So unless things are really terrible, we're going to be slightly happy. And then the job of positive psychology will move you up to be even happier, but people are sort of built at this level. Now, here are the implications of this. First of all, people are resilient. They bounce back to some extent. Most people, sometimes they can certainly use your help, but they're eventually going to bounce back. Secondly, chronic unhappiness is harmful. It's not normal. Barbara Ehrenreich writes a book, wow, it's really great to be unhappy. You really shouldn't be happy. This is crazy stuff. The evidence points in the other direction very heavily. And then finally, remember that if you get slightly positive responses, your teacher ratings or ratings of a movie or interventions make people a little bit happy, you have to really say, yeah, but maybe that's telling us more about human nature than it is about the target of the thing. So you really need something above slight happiness, because that's sort of where our resting baseline point is, to show that something is really efficacious in being popular or moving people to the happy end. Okay, so that's the end of that topic. And the next topic I want to talk about is the one that Marty and I wrote a 2005 article. And you remember we wrote an article, Beyond Income, and it was toward an economy of well-being. And what we said there was that, yeah, money's important. We don't want to say that money's not important. Of course, you've got to have money for food and shelter and travel and even doing some fun things. But what we have to emphasize as positive psychologists, that there's plenty of people emphasizing money. Believe me, you don't need to help them. What we have to emphasize as positive psychologists is the other things that are important, and make policymakers and leaders realize that there are other universals that predict happiness sometimes more strongly than money. And we have to make the people, our leaders, aware of that. Here are some things from the Gallup World Poll that we find are not as important, but more important in predicting enjoying life than our money. Social support. I have someone I can count on in an emergency. Very important, and varies a lot around the world, as I'll show you. Social trust. I trust most other people around me, even strangers. I don't trust everybody, but I trust most people. They're not corrupt. They're not going to steal from me or beat me up. Mastery. This one really surprised me, because you hear so much about how kids grow up in school and they hate learning and all that. The number one predictor of enjoyment was I learned new things and I used my abilities today. Number one predictor of enjoyment in the Gallup World Poll. And then control of one's own life, right? You don't have people all the time telling you what to do. You get to make some of the major decisions in your life. And everybody says, oh, these things are cross-cultural and they're just in America because we're individualistic. They predict in every world region people's subjective well-being and how much they're enjoying and liking their life. Here are two countries that I want to compare with you. And I want to show you these two countries because South Korea is kind of a sad case of a country that got great economic growth. It's one of the Asian tigers, compared to Costa Rica. Now, what you see on this graph, which plots income in logs against life evaluation, is that there is certainly a correlation, a strong one, between the income of a country and the average life satisfaction there. But what you also see is that Costa Rica's income, and that's the president of Costa Rica, the lady up there, and is income is substantially less And a half a log, you know, is four or five times one-fifth of what Korea's is, and Korea's life satisfaction is much lower. So how could this be? Korea, with so much money now, it's one of the richest countries in the world. So from the Gallup World Poll, look at these data. I am not respected. South Korea, one-third of the respondents are saying, I'm not respected. That's terrible. Whereas in Costa Rica, only 1 in 20 feel that people don't respect them. I don't have social support. Now, remember that question is, I have people I can count on in an emergency. We want everybody to have somebody to count on in an emergency. If you don't have that, right, that's really terrible. And 1 in 5 people in Korea say, I do not have that. I'm not satisfied with my standard of living. 1 in 3 in South Korea, and the economy is just booming, and people are making lots of money, and they're still not satisfied, and 1 in 4 don't like their jobs, compared to in Costa Rica, where 1 in 10 don't. So this is sorry. I mean, this is really a sad thing. And here you can see the subjective well-being scores, and what you see is life satisfaction in Korea is barely above the neutral point of the scale, despite its wealth. Look down at the bottom of the average income in Korea, $46,500 per person, that's GDP per capita, whereas in Costa Rica it's $12,800. Amazing difference. Koreans make four times as much money, and yet they are much less satisfied with their life. Positive feeling, 67% versus 88%, huge difference. And then the negative feelings are pretty similar, except once again, South Koreans are higher. And then the most telling statistic of all, which I didn't put up here, which I should have, is the suicide rate. The suicide rate in South Korea is by far the highest in the OECD countries, the 34 richest countries in the world, and women there outpace the number two country hugely. And men commit suicide there more than the second place too, but it's not so big. But so they commit suicide at a greater rate, they're less happy and so forth. What on earth is going on? And they asked me to come there and talk about that. And I tried to figure it out. So here are some of the things that I figured out that many people there said, yes, you're right. The first one is constant competition. You're not taught that you should do your best and use your standards to evaluate yourself. When I occasionally would get straight A's as a kid, my parents would say, well, you know, that's fine, but we don't care if you got straight A's. You're reasonably smart. What we care about is, did you try your hardest and do your best every minute? And if you did that, and got C's, that would be fine. And if you didn't do that and got A's, then, you know, we want you to always be working hard and doing your best. In Korea, they have constant competition. You have to beat the other person. You're always comparing yourself. Social comparison is constant. We hear so many people that think collectivism is great and individualism is bad. And it's true that both of them have bad things, but both of them have good things too. But let me just talk about the downside of collectivism, since we hear so much about, you know, how people will support you and stand by you and all that. You're in group. Well, one of the bad things about collectivism is that normally it extends to your inner circle, your in group. And once you go outside the inner circle, the bridging form of social capital, now you don't care as much about the out-group. So when you start getting people urbanized, like is happening in China, you get a bunch of collectivists together, now all of a sudden individualists, right, care a little bit more about strangers than collectivists. That's surprising, right? We actually are willing to help a stranger more. So that's one of the bad things about collectivism, and you see then that has the spin-off that in urban areas you're around strangers a lot of the time and you fail to have that social support. But the other one is that you're always worried about what people think of you, and that helps keep you out of trouble. So you see crime rates typically in collectivist countries are like in Asia at least, are lower because you're very worried about your family's evaluation. But then when you enter the market economy and you have this booming economy, you also worry about what other people think of you in terms of luxury goods and how you're doing, how you look, and so they have high levels of anorexia there. You wonder about how you appear, so you want to buy a Rolex watch and expensive cars. So you're always competing. So constantly there, I heard, everybody's in competition. The kids in the most elite universities are committing suicide at a very high rate. Rose Inzakim told me one a month in these colleges committing suicide. And a high degree of materialism because this concern for appearance. And so what's happened then is that we have an Asian tiger of economic growth that shows that money is not sufficient to produce high quality of life, high subjective well-being. And that's a sad thing, but it's a lesson for China and the rest of the world that we have to retain the social psychological capital and build that, not just build money. Now, I wanted to tell you about my un-Maslow finding because I do think that it has something to do with economics not having the priority, and that is that fulfilling needs out of order is still fulfilling. And you remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Of course, you all know that. And the physiological and those down at the bottom are what economists are working on. And they say, once we get those all fulfilled, then we'll work on self-actualization. Let's put it off. Well, our pyramid from the Gallup World Poll looks more like this. It's all mixed together. Even when you're hungry, you can still work on respect and social relations and self-actualization. And of course, you'd be even happier if you had enough food, but you can work on all your needs all the time. And so this is our revised pyramid. Now, Robert, our son, collected data in the slums of Calcutta, and this fellow, Minaj, was one of his subjects. And he said to Minaj, you told me you were pretty happy, and I don't understand that. This is at the end of the interview of the survey, and he said, you know, you've got so many problems. Some days you don't have enough money to feed your kids. How can you be happy? Minaj said, well, you know, I go off to work, and I drive a rickshaw. You can see his picture there. You can see his house there, too, right? Very poor housing. And I kind of enjoy driving a rickshaw, believe it or not. I kind of like work, and I talk to the people and so forth and talk to other rickshaw drivers, and I kind of like that. But then on the way home, I take a penny or two, and I buy a candy. And I'm walking home, and when I'm way far away, my kids see me, and they come running, Dad, Dad, Dad. And they give me a big hug, and then they step back. Look of anticipation. And I pull out the candy, and they squeal. They were expecting and hoping for it, and they're excited. And I give it to them, and they're laughing. That's why I'm happy, because I love them so much, and they love me so much. So you see, Minaj, some days did not make $3 so he could feed his whole family. They didn't have enough food. But he still got spiritual things. He still got close relationships. He has work that he enjoys, etc. So there's a lot more in life than money. We don't want to denigrate the importance of money, but we want to say to economists and our leaders, you've got to have these other things. And we're here to tell you that money is not enough, that you've got to have the psychosocial wealth as well. One of the themes I wanted to tell you about is there's cross-cultural specifics, because I think this is so important when you evaluate the literature. And the one I'm going to tell you about is religion. We found other ones like this, congruence. Extroverts are happier in extroverted countries. They're slightly happier in introverted countries, but there's hardly any difference. But in extroverted countries like the USA, extroverts are really have more positive affect. So there's this congruence effect. And the congruence effect I want to tell you about here is about religion, because we've heard so much about religious people being happier. And we did 120 countries in the world, and what we found was, religious people are happier in religious countries. And guess where most of the research has been done? In the USA. And guess what's a religious country? The USA is pretty religious. But when you look at all countries in the world, it looks like this. So on the far right, those two bars, the red bar and the blue bar, those are non-religious countries like Sweden, where 20% of the people go to church, 20% of the people think religion's important in their everyday life. And you see the two bars are very religious people and non-religious people, and they're about equally happy, positive feelings. You see that enjoying life. In fact, the non-religious people are slightly and significantly higher there. But if you look at religious countries, you see a huge effect. The Saudi Arabias of the world, where religious people are just way happier. And if you're a non-religious person in Saudi Arabia, you're in trouble. You see how low your life satisfaction is there, the blue short line. So there's a strong religious congruence effect. And that's interesting. Now, the people on the right might be spiritual, whether they're religious or not. We don't know that. But the point being, you have to look at effects like this in research and say, are they universal or are they specific to a certain group? So I don't want to apply them to my clients unless I'm pretty certain that they're generalizable. Okay, I'm moving kind of fast here. So Marty, in that same article, and I said in 2005, we ought to institute accounts of well-being. Why is that? We ought to do that because if you measure something, society pays attention to it. If you measure crime, people get worried about crime. You measure the economy, which we do, everybody's worried about unemployment, they may vote out Obama if the unemployment goes any higher. So people really pay attention. If you measure education and put it up there, they say, hey, we want better schools because we're not beating Korea, we're not beating Japan. So if you measure well-being of all the sorts that people here in this room talk about, people will start paying attention to that. Our leaders will. People, the ordinary citizens will. So we've made a little bit of advance on that. And the United Kingdom and Mexico, the OECD countries, are starting to adopt that, make prototype measures and so forth. So David Cameron, due to Marty Seligman and Felicia Huppert and others' effort, NEF in England, David Cameron on our Thanksgiving Day announced this well-being measure for the United Kingdom, four items: satisfied with life, happy, not feeling anxious, and feeling that your life is worthwhile. Now, this is not an adequate measure, but it's a foot in the door, and it's the most we can hope for initially. This is more than you can hope for, to get four measures in, and then start showing that they do tell us things about different groups and so forth, and over time. And once that happens, we can start expanding to the more lengthy measures that we'd like to see. But this is a real beginning. United Nations talked about it. The OECD is very big because they coordinate statistics between countries. They're coming up with prototype measures. So we've really been making some advances on this. And then the final thing I wanted to talk about today, and I know I'm going kind of fast because I have so much, but is the importance of meaning and purpose to life satisfaction. So this is what I think is kind of an interesting finding. Marty's worried that life satisfaction may just reflect the pleasure that you're having a good time in life. And if you're having a good enough time in life, I'll show you this slide, maybe that's sufficient. But when you have meaning and purpose, and you think your life is important and worthwhile, that really protects you. So what I'm going to show you is life satisfaction plotted against how happy you are moment to moment. People are happy all the time, people aren't happy. And then also divided by low and high people who are high and low in meaning and purpose in life. Here's the slide. The dotted line is people who are low in meaning and purpose. And as what you can see is that that line is very steep. If you're not having a good time, you are dissatisfied. You're down at the depressed level. If you're having a great time, all the time you're just really good, you say, yeah, I'm satisfied. But for purpose and meaning, how happy you are moment to moment only makes a slight difference. The line sort of just barely goes up. And what happens is, even if you're not having a great time and you're high in meaning and purpose, you're high in life satisfaction. So it's almost like having meaning and purpose in life is sort of a guarantee almost that you're going to be pretty happy. And you may not be having as much fun as you want, but you're going to find your life to be fulfilling. Okay, so life satisfaction isn't just pleasure. It reflects people's goals, needs, fulfillment, and values, and importantly, purpose and meaning. So let me just wind up here with some conclusions. Subjective well-being provides a natural advantage, that is a selective advantage, health, fertility, fecundity. And therefore, evolution has created us to be moderately happy. I would say slightly to moderately happy. In that range, there's still plenty of room for us to move people up, plenty of room to learn to be happier, to be more optimistic. But on average, we're mostly prone to be slightly happy. And if people aren't that way, you know, there's a real problem there. Meaning and purpose, as well as need satisfaction, raise life satisfaction. I think this is important. Religion's effect depends on one's culture, and many things do. I told extroversion, I'd like to start looking at more and more things and see how culturally different they are across the world. And finally, and I think importantly, we are making progress on National Council's subjective well-being. So that's very encouraging for this group in this room, because I think it will highlight all the work that you people are doing. So if you want a copy of this talk, you can give me your card or you can email me. Simple email, edeaner@illinois.edu. And thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this keynote address by Dr. Ed Diener. You may recall my show a few episodes back in which I interviewed his son. That was in episode number 270, Unlocking Psychological Wealth with Robert Biswas Diener, PhD. And you might recall that he had been called the Harrison Ford of positive psychology, and he described his dad as the Jedi Master of positive psychology. One of the things that really strikes me is that Dr. Ed Diener has been studying subjective well-being for well over 30 years, and that's certainly an aspect of happiness, subjective well-being. And the thing that strikes me is that it predates the creation of positive psychology as a separate field. So while Martin Seligman declared the existence of a new field within psychology called positive psychology without really giving much credit to humanistic psychology, which had run 40 years prior to that, here was Ed Diener, one among many who was conducting research that was certainly, I think, would have fallen under the rubric easily of humanistic psychological research as well as positive psychological research, even though that term hadn't been invented yet. Now, I don't know if Dr. Diener would have described himself as a humanistic psychologist way back then or not, but it seems to me he'd fit as easily under that umbrella as under positive psychology. Now, it should be noted that subjective well-being is based on self-report, and that has often been cited as a weakness of positive psychology in general, that so much of the research is based on rating scales that people take themselves, in other words, self-report. However, Dr. Diener has gathered so much data over so many years and across so many different cultures that I would say it's quite solid. Some of the points that really stood out for me in his presentation are that despite difficult challenges around the world, most people report that they are happy. And I think that's a testimony to our evolutionarily built-in resilience. His research, again, across cultures, indicates that happy people have better health, they live longer, they have healthier babies, they have better fertility, and they have access to more resources. And he says there are 150 studies, actually, that do show a causal relationship in relation to these factors. He goes on to say that 125 of 128 nations, most people felt positive for much of the day before. Even when they looked at people in bad circumstances, you know, not enough money, not enough food, not good shelter, etc., 57% felt positive most of the day before, and 62% reported that they had smiled a lot the previous day. So he concludes that chronic unhappiness is harmful and not normal. And also his research underscores what we've seen before in other studies, that there's more to life than money. Money is not the most important thing. And he cites a comparison between Costa Rica and South Korea. Now, South Korea is a very wealthy country. It's been referred to as the Asian tiger. But subjective well-being is not terribly high there because of constant competition, constant social comparison, concern about appearance and luxury goods, and a high degree of materialism. And that was contrasted with Costa Rica, where subject well-being is high, but all of those, but income is overall low. So we see that gross national product, GNP indices, are not good enough. And we previously heard about the program in Bhutan trying to monitor national happiness. And he cites the UK in instituting a well-being index. Finally, the point that stands out is that we know that there has been research suggesting that religious beliefs and so on can add to one's resilience and add to happiness. But he says the religion's effects depend upon one's culture. So that's kind of, it kind of varies from culture to culture. Okay, well, let's move on to a few of the other interviews I conducted among conference attendees, and I offer these without additional comment. Hi, what's your name, and what school are you from?
Amy Gensler from West Virginia University.
Okay, and what do you do there, Amy?
I'm an assistant professor of psychology.
All right, I am a retired professor myself. What do you teach?
Lifespan developmental psychology. I teach classes in social psychology, child development, and emotions.
So what is it that brings you to this conference?
Our lab has been doing a lot of work with respect to how people respond to positive events. We know a lot about how people might vary in how they respond to negative events. There's a whole stress and coping literature, so we know a good deal about what's adaptive in terms of effective coping strategies, but there's a lot to be known about how people can more effectively respond to positive events.
Well, that's great. Can you give us a sort of a top-line result from any of your research? Anything surprising or particularly interesting that you found out?
Well, so far it's been a lot in line with what we expected, in that there's responses that allow you to kind of savor or maximize what you get out of positive events. So if something good happens to you and you share it with other people, if you think about it a lot, and there are certain adaptive strategies. And then there's other strategies that might kind of minimize how much you get from these positive events. So if you don't think about it, if you don't share it with other people, or if you kind of downplay, oh, it was just luck, or it, you know, it wasn't an important factor.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for interviewing. Okay, so I'm talking to Tracy Epps Johnson here, who is at a booth called Points of View, the coaching game. Tell us what that is, Tracy.
The coaching game is really a tool to facilitate conversations, to get people to be able to explore different perspectives, different points of views, and to really dig deeply on an issue that they want to get more clarity about. It's a great way to start conversations.
I think it's an intriguing idea. I'm somebody who's over the years has done things with a tarot deck. And so in a way, this is kind of like the idea of tarot, not so much to give a personality reading, I guess, but to bring up points for discussion.
Absolutely. You know, the expression, a picture is better than a thousand words. Every image draws an emotion, makes you feel something, takes you back to a place that you may have been before. And hundreds of people can look at a single image and each one interpret it differently. Each one have a different feeling come to rise about it. So it's unique in that the images in the game are 65 different images drawn from photographers from all over the world. And there are words or phrases on the cards that make you think even more deeply about the topics. So it's a way to explore and perhaps look through an image and really express how you feel about things.
Well, take us through two or three images, and I know you can't show them, but you can kind of describe, tell us what the word is. And I guess you use these in the context of something that coaches would find valuable in working with somebody to
kind of discuss some of their issues?
Certainly, certainly. Well, for example, perhaps there's someone who's starting a new job and they pull an image from the deck and there's a picture of feet with mud and dirt all over them and it looks like they've been sloshing in the water. And the word that's on that card is difficulty. And perhaps in the context of this new job, they're apprehensive and concerned about the difficulty that they may face. So that image speaks to them and makes them think about, you know, why am I feeling like this is going to be so hard? I'm prepared for it. I'm trained. And it sparks a conversation about that.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, would you have them sort of shuffle through all the cards face up, looking for one that applies to their situation, or would they draw a card randomly, or what?
Well, you know, you can do it either way. There's a lot of flexibility and versatility in how the game is used. For example, I had an argument with my husband one morning, and I had the game in my briefcase. So I just pulled it out. And the first card I drew was one that said difficulty. And I said, oh, no, I don't want to deal with that. And I put it back on the deck. And then I pulled another one randomly, and that one was an image of a one-way sign. And so I said, oh, no, not that one either. Put that one back. I pulled another blind one blindly, and that one was intimacy. And so I was in a mindset where all of those images spoke to me.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know about putting those away.
Exactly, exactly. So whether you look at the images or pull them from your deck, it depends on your state of mind. You may find a connection with them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
So tell us about your poster here. Give us your name and title of your study.
Sure. My name is Perry Edelman. I'm Director of Wellness Research at Mather Lifeways Institute on Aging. And the title is Positive Psychology in Aging, Character Strengths in Older Adults. And what I did was, my intention was to identify older adults' perspective on a number of issues related to positive psychology. This particular poster focuses on character strengths. And what I did was, first I conducted focus groups with 57 individuals in continuing care retirement community, really to identify a limited number of the 24 character strengths that have been identified by positive psychologists as universal. I had to limit it because I then wanted to do a survey, and 24 character strengths would be a lot to ask.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so we identified 14 character strengths. They're listed here. I don't know if you really want me to read them to you.
I'll read a few of them. They're fairness, humor, gratitude, appreciation of beauty, modesty, forgiveness, social intelligence, love, kindness, zest, authenticity, perspective, open-mindedness, and love of learning.
Yes. And the character strengths are organized by six virtues. And the virtues that the group that was surveyed identified as this was 132 residents of a continuing care retirement community, identified humanity and wisdom and knowledge as most important. Within humanity, the character strength they identified as most important was kindness. Within wisdom and knowledge, they identified open-mindedness as most important.
What are the implications of this for the future, or for older people such as myself?
Well, again, in this group was very interested in improving a number of character strengths. In fact, on 9 of the 14 character strengths we asked them about, 30-40% indicated they would be very interested in improving those 9 character strengths. So my goal is this year to work with a group of older adults and have them identify character strengths that they're most interested in improving, and give them exercises and activities that they can use to improve those character strengths. And the nice thing about this character strengths with older adults is I believe that character strengths are a strength of older adults. So in a sense, we're building from their strengths, which is not always the case with older adults. And older adults are often working on weaknesses and compensating. But to me, older adults when it comes to character strengths, they shine because they've had all the years of experience and time to develop those and the insight, etc.
Amen, brother. That sounds good to me. Did you attend any of the large sessions like last night, the presentations?
I did attend last night and this morning's presentation, yeah.
Okay, I'm wondering if there's any one or two points that were really salient to you that stand out. This might be a difficult question because my memory's not terribly good.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was so. I think to me it's what I took away from all this so far is not the specifics, but kind of the feeling, the emotion, the commitment, if you will, of the speakers and I think probably a large portion of the audience, of the participants here. And there was a lot of specific information that I too am not able to recall at this moment, but I think it was that feeling of this is a really important thing for us to be working on in the area of positive psychology.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, I see you have a very interesting poster exhibit here about research among retired elders in Taipei. What's your name?
My name is Tony Lee.
Okay, and are you a student or a professor somewhere?
I'm a professor at the National Taiwan Normal University.
Oh, very interesting. So tell us what you found out here.
Okay, basically we are trying to understand the happiness of happiness state of Taiwan elders. And so actually we develop a measure, 10 items to measure the happiness in Taiwan, and we propose that the positive environment and positive personality trait can predict the elders' happiness.
And I see you used factors like living status, economic status, family relationships, meaningfulness, comprehensibility, manageability. And did these, in fact, predict happiness?
Yes. Our results shows that the family environment, if that's supportive, that can increase the happiness of our elders. And also the sense of coherence as the positive trait, it's a partially mediator for those two variables.
Okay, well, I'm an elder myself. What's your advice to me to be happy?
Well, first one, you have to build a good relationship with your family. And second one is to think positively about the future.
Okay, well, Professor, that sounds like great advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Happy Friday, everyone. And if you're not hearing this on Friday, well, happy whatever day it is. Hey, I haven't received any feedback at all on the last episode with Martin Seligman. I know I tried listening to that one with my son in the car, and the audio just wasn't good enough for listening in a car at high speed. This is making me wonder if it was good enough for listening to at all. So please let me know. I thought this was a very important episode, and would like some confirmation one way or the other. I think today's audio with Ed Diener is better for some reason. Maybe his voice is pitched a little bit different. Do you agree? My adult son, Jonathan, has been staying back home with us for the summer, and sometimes when we're together on a drive, he will suggest listening to one of my podcasts, which, of course, I find very gratifying. Just this past week, we were listening to my interview with Rocco Bellick about his film Happy. I don't know if it's my failing memory or just the different perspective of being a listener rather than an interviewer, but I notice when I do this, it's like I'm hearing the interview for the first time. I'm hearing all sorts of great stuff that I had either missed or had forgotten. Now, all modesty aside, I had to exclaim to Jonathan, "This is great stuff! I'm loving this interview! I can see why I've heard from so many of you that you listen to these interviews more than once. There's so much to digest, usually, that it doesn't always stick from just one listening. I've noticed that every time I listen back, I learn some new facts or stories that I had completely forgotten. This experience has freshly impressed upon me that I really deserve to be compensated for all the work I'm putting in producing these shows for you. Really, if you haven't made a donation either one time or ongoing, you should be doing it if you can at all afford to do so. I know a number of podcasters who are, quotes, monetizing their shows by locking away some of the content so that only paid subscribers can get the premium content. Well, as far as I'm concerned, this is all premium content. I can't produce any more than I'm doing already, and it just doesn't sit well with my values to lock any part of it away. So please go to that big green donate button on the Shrink Wrap Radio site today. For the month of August, I probably spent 40 hours producing 4 podcasts for you on Shrink Wrap Radio, because each one takes about 10 hours in all. I received a total of $295 in donations for August, and that comes out to about $7 an hour. Hardly a princely sum. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm very grateful to those donors. Without them, it would be $0 per hour, which would be really hard on the old self-esteem. So I would like to publicly thank these August donors, both one-time and ongoing donors, and I hope they won't mind my reading out their names. They are Daniel Gold, Jamie Johnson, Judith Rubin, Doreen Baldridge, Michael Klepsies, Miche Belitis, Edward Murray, Srinivasa Rao, Sylvie Barut, Simon Huggins, Andy Hunt, Peggy Roberts, Peter Myron, Trevor Ullman, Rodrigo Ochoa Rubin, Jay Ahrens, Valerie Pratt, Joseph Pentany, Nina Burrows, and Mary Anderson. And I apologize for any names that I butchered here, but I am so grateful to each and every one of you. Now, won't you please add your name to this list of stalwarts by going to the Shrink Wrap Radio site and clicking on the big green donate button? And while you're going to that big green donate button, you can also click on the link beneath it to the book depository and order books at discounted prices shipped anywhere in the world. For example, Dr. Ed Diener has a number of books you can order there, including the one he co-wrote with his son. The title of that one is Happiness, Unlocking the Mysteries of Psychological Wealth. And it's a good one. I read it. Now, speaking of gratitude, I want to thank listener Deborah Swain for very quickly producing a transcript of my interview with Pilar Jennings. That's number 269, The Power of Relationship in Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, with Pilar Jennings, Ph.D., and you'll find that in the transcripts area on the page. Thanks for stepping up, Deborah. By the way, there have been some personnel changes at mentalhelp.net, who host my Wise Counsel podcasts. Consequently, for the time being, it looks like they'll only be putting up one episode a month instead of the 2 monthly ones they had been doing. I heard from listener Peter Sear in the UK, who is both an architect and an advanced student of Jungian psychology, and he requested that I refer you to his blog at www.poeticspaces.co.uk. I'm happy to do so. It's a very thoughtful exploration of the psychic dimensions of the spaces in which we work and live and play.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
So let's take a dip into our email bag for some recent communications from our listener community. First, we hear from longtime UK listener and donor Simon Huggins, who writes, "Hi, David. Just listened to a really interesting interview with Dean Buonomano, neurobiology professor at UCLA, who has recently released a book called Brain Bugs, about the ways that our brains deceive us, especially given that we are having to adapt to changes that seem to far outstrip our evolutionary mechanisms we have taken millions of years to develop." And then he gives me the link to the podcast, which is on Tech Nation. It's the July 26, 2011 edition of Tech Nation, which for a long time was one of my favorite podcasts, and I've just kind of drifted away from it. But I love Moira Gunn is the interviewer, and she does a wonderful job. She's one of my ideal interviewers, along with Terry Gross. Would love to meet her. She is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And Simon goes on to say, "It would be great to have a more psychological bias on the subject matter, so I feel this would benefit from the Dr. Dave treatment." Thank you. "And a slightly longer interview would be great, too, to go into a little more depth." You know, I was listening to that interview, and it cut off suddenly, and I don't know if that was a problem on my end or if that's just how it was posted, but it ended rather abruptly. I was enjoying it. I think I heard about 15 or 20 minutes worth, and then, boop, it was gone. That's me speaking, David. Simon continues, "I know you've got a bit of a backlog, but thought it might be of interest given the direction of some of your more recent interviews. Thanks again for what is undoubtedly the most consistently excellent podcast in the field of psychology." Whoa, thank you so much. All the best, Simon Huggins, Ipswich, UK. And we'll just pretend that we never heard that little telephone ring in the background there. Simon, thanks so much for your ongoing support and for your encouragement. And I will definitely add Dr. Buonomano to my list of possible guests. And I'll try to see if I got to hear the entire interview or not. I'm not sure. Next, we hear from listener and recent donor Sylvie Berut. And I apologize if I mispronounced that. Sylvie is in Switzerland, and she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm listening to your podcast for about 4 years now, and I'm always impressed and pleased by the variety of the topics, the quality of your guests, your great job as an interviewer, and the care you take in editing the episodes." Thank you so much, Sylvie. "Being very interested in psychology, especially analytical psychology," and by the way, P.S. listeners, the word analytical psychology refers specifically to Jungian analysis. So back to Sylvie's. "Being very interested in psychology, especially analytical psychology, your podcast is for me a great opportunity to learn and to know the current developments in the field. It's also a good way to improve my knowledge of English, psychological vocabulary, which was of great help for me when I took English courses at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich." Lucky you. That's great. "Therefore, it was normal to pay back a little for all that I have received. Thanks a lot and keep up this great work warmly." And that's from Sylvie Berut in Switzerland. Thank you so much for your kind words, Sylvie, and for your tangible support. And we're all envious of your ability to be there in Switzerland, so close to the heartland of Jungian psychology. Now here's one from longtime listener John, who posted a comment reacting to my interview with David Eagleman on The Secret Lives of the Brain. And John writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Cool interview. I particularly liked hearing the rabies explanation, as it's something I've often thought about, but hearing it come from someone with more authority was very gratifying." Now, he's referring there to a part of the interview where Dr. Eagleman was talking about how the tiny organism that is rabies can end up taking control of the much larger organism of the human being or the affected animal. So that's what he's responding to. It's kind of amazing that such a small organism can take over such a large organism. Back to John's note, he goes on to say, I think it gives credence to the Jungian topographic model of the psyche, updated from Freud's, that has the typical triangle/iceberg motif, but also surrounded by a circle representing the body. I think it also gives credence to the Jungian concept that consciousness is really more of an extension of the unconscious and not the other way around. However, I was somewhat concerned at the start of the show with his use of the term subconscious. As you are probably aware, it was Freud who was the first major objector to this term, and it has traditionally been avoided in academic settings, with the general public keeping the term going. Freud dubbed the term inaccurate and misleading, going on to say that when someone uses the term, he wasn't sure whether they were speaking topographically or qualitatively, and in all likelihood, those who employ the term probably aren't sure about the subject on which they are speaking. However, I keep seeing the term used occasionally in modern textbooks and was wondering whether the psychodynamic field's objection to the term has since become irrelevant, and if these days the two are now treated as synonymous, despite the semantic inaccuracy of subconscious. Or, for a much simpler scenario, would it be much more likely that it's just a slip of the tongue on Dr. Eagleman's part, particularly after dealing with the public? You mentioned at the end of the show that you would have been interested in exploring some of the weirder phenomena like automatic writing and so on, particularly in the case of multiple personalities in the unconscious. I can't think of a better term right now, he says. I was wondering if you've read Jung's earlier works and dealing with so-called occult phenomena in Collected Works 1, if I remember correctly. This was also the time of some of the freakier stuff in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Well, John, to speak to your question about the subconscious, I think that in analytic circles and, you know, really well-trained therapists, they would be alert, as you are, to the distinction and not use the word subconscious, but rather the word unconscious. However, it has become so widely accepted in general parlance that they have become pretty much synonymous. So I guess we'll just have to leave it there. Finally, here's one more from listener and new donor, Mishai Bilitis, no idea if I'm at all close, who writes, Hi, David. It's a pleasure to support your work. I'm constantly inspired and enlightened by the people you interview and the humility and insight you bring to each interview. Warm regards, Mishai. Well, I'm so glad to learn that you've been out there for the past 4 years listening to this show, and I thank you so much for your support and for taking time to write. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, like John did. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Ed Diener for allowing me to share his keynote and PowerPoint deck from the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology. At this point, I'm not certain who my next episode will feature. I recorded one additional keynote, a presentation by the noted brain and meditation researcher, Dr. Richard Davis, whom I previously interviewed. I've sent off an email to him requesting permission to use that recording. If I don't get that permission, I do have some other interviews ready to go. So, we'll see. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.